Socrates, Part 3, and Plato, Part 1, the eighth talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 28, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handouts mentioned in this talk are handouts number 3 and 4 in this series.
If you have your Socrates handout, I'm going to be looking at the second page. The Socratic method, there's a famous concept called the Socratic dialectic. And once upon a time, a number of years ago, I read a whole book on it, and I still don't understand it. I think it's a pretty controversial issue exactly what Socrates meant by the dialectic. He means at least one thing, and there's a second thing that I know could be what he means by it. And then this book said there were some other possibilities, but I don't understand those. Fundamentally, what he means by the dialectic is his method of analyzing concepts. So let me give you an example. In his dialogue, the Meno, the question that's being discussed by the people in the conversation is, what is virtue? They translate it virtue. I think we talked about this, didn't we? Virtue is excellence. And one of the things he does there, excuse me, is they offer different definitions of excellence, and they decide that what it means to be excellent as a slave is different than what it means to be excellent as a flute player, is different than what it means to be excellent as, and I don't remember all the other examples, but there's different kind of excellence depending upon what your role is and what your function is and who you are exactly. And Socrates then, as is very typical in his dialogues, will say, well, no, you've given me examples of excellence, but what I want to know is, what is it that all of those have in common that make them all excellence? So it's one thing to know what it's like to be an excellent flute player, and another thing to know what it's like to be an excellent slave, but but what would they both have in common, a good flute player and a good servant, such that they would both be called excellent? What is it exactly to be excellent in and of itself? So what Socrates is doing is he's trying to analyze concepts by taking a general concept and breaking that concept down into individual components or individual kinds within that overall kind. So we're quite familiar with that process. Of course, in biology, for example, you have the kingdom, and what do you divide the kingdom up into? Families. And so you break something down, break it down again, break it down again, break it down again, until you actually get to something that you can't break down any longer. Well, that process of analyzing concepts into their distinctive parts and grouping them according to things that they have in common, that's the most typical way that Socrates uses the word dialectic. It's that reasoning that is dividing, is finding distinctions, important distinctions. Now, for Socrates, as we've seen, he's mostly interested, he's not interested in botany, biology, astronomy, nature, cosmos. He's interested in ethics. So for him, what's critical is, how can I be a just person if I don't know what justice is? And in order to know what justice is, you're going to have to know the different kinds of situations in which you might talk about justice. And by recognizing that, well, in this situation, justice is this kind of thing. In this situation, justice would be this kind of thing. You can't hang around philosophy very much without coming to realize how important making valuable distinctions is. because so much confusion and so much lack of clarity in human thought happens because we're not making the right kinds of distinctions. When we use the same word to describe things that are different from each other, then we confuse the one for the other very, very readily. Another dialogue that called the Phaedrus, he talks about love, and he gives one speech in praise of love, one speech where he advises a lover to not the beloved to not love the lover, and another speech where he advises exactly the opposite. Well, the whole confusion is resting on not making a distinction between love as sexual and physical attraction versus love as a love for goodness, for example. We use the same word, but they're radically different ideas, radically different concepts. And if you're not prepared to make a distinction between love in this sense versus love in this other sense, then you're likely in your reasoning and your thinking to confuse the two and think that, well, love is love, right? Isn't love love? Well, raw animal physical attraction is a very different thing from the love of righteousness and have very, very different implications. If you just conflate them by noticing that you use the same word to describe them, then your thinking is going to be very muddled indeed. And that, I think that's the whole point of that. One of the major points of that dialogue is to show the consequences in not keeping clear. So it's through the dialectic. There's love, but then there's love in this sense and love in this sense and love in this other sense, and then breaking it down as finely as you need to go until you have real clarity about what the concept is and what its implications are. That's the dialectic. Questions on that?
When I think of method, I think of a method in teaching,
okay,
by questioning,
uh-huh,
rather than telling.
Right.
Is that something else, or is that connected here?
It is something else, but most people, when they talk about dialectic, that's what they mean by it. And it might be that that's what Socrates means by it, or what Plato means by it. I'm not as sure that that's the case. Whenever you see the word dialectic in a dialogue in a certain context, it could mean what I just described, and it works. Or in that same context, it could work to be describing the back and forth, the give and take between two conversants in a discussion. In any case, that is the Socratic method. Whether that's the Socratic dialectic or not is another question, but in any case, it is a method that Socrates uses. Socrates rather cleverly and delightfully describes himself as taking after his mother, who is a midwife, because he sees his goal as taking souls that are pregnant with knowledge and delivering their knowledge. And that, so his pedagogical method is to enter into dialogue with them, enter into conversation with them, and by asking well-placed questions to get them to come to realize what it is that they already know. And he likens that to delivering their children.
So, first an observation, we must all drive you crazy by not making the distinctions that have become so obvious that you must make all the time, having gotten a PhD in philosophy. I'm sorry.
That kind of sounds like...
I wouldn't say any of you drive me crazy, but it does drive me crazy in the popular discourse that goes on, the incredible confusion that exists where people talk past each other, not being even aware of the distinctions that need to be made. That does drive me crazy.
Not clarifying. And we must do it some. I mean, I must do it some. I know I do. And I think it's pretty obvious what you mean by this. But I wonder to, so I can clarify to make sure I'm getting it, and I will remember it better if there's a example that you give and break down. I know that she gave one, but I didn't follow it.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Naomi broke some, I don't know what her example was, because I didn't get it. So, okay. Good. Okay, so, like breaking down love or virtue or justice or something like that, that Socrates may...
Well, okay, here's a big one that is in the middle, that creates the cultural war, political war that goes on in America today. Just take something like the concept of fairness. Well, we use fairness in two very, very different senses. In one sense, we can use it to mean a kind of equality, equality of circumstances, equality of situation. And so we would say something is not fair if the state and outcome and condition of everybody is not somehow roughly the same. That's not fair, we might say. On the other hand, if I work hard and buy something and someone comes along and steals it, we consider it not fair that they would take from me by deception or force or something that they have not earned that I earned. That's not fair either. Well, it's very important that we take this concept, this word fair, that can mean two very, very different things, significantly different things, and make the distinction, fairness in this sense and fairness in this other sense. So some people are for fairness, but they're against fairness. They're for fairness in the first sense, but they're against fairness in the second sense. And then other people is the reverse of that. They're for fairness in this sense and against fairness in this sense, or at least not champions of fairness in the second sense. So if we just talk about we want fairness in our society, the first question we have to ask is, wait, what kind of fairness do we want? What kind of fairness makes the most stable and just and good society? If we don't ask that question, then there's a lot of confusion. And notice that a word like fairness has a kind of an emotional value attached to it. Yeah, I'm for fairness. Well, that's what demagogues absolutely depend on, is the emotional value of a word getting you on board, and then they do a bait and switch on you somewhere along the line. You didn't really know that what you were signing up for was this, when they change the meaning of the word or the sense in which they mean the word on you and sell you something on the emotional cash value of the word fair, something that if you had actually stopped to think about it and analyze it, you may not have been on board with that. And that's how demagogues work, is that they leave things vague and appeal to you on a very vague level with words that have some kind of emotional cash value, and then take you somewhere where you may not have even wanted to go. Let me think of an example in Christianity. This isn't really a matter of an ambiguity, but the way we use the word faith in Christianity, we use faith in several different senses. So somebody over here can use faith to mean something that is not rational, but I believe it anyway, and that there's some virtue in believing something just out of some kind of loyalty and commitment to it. But, you know, my reason, it doesn't make any sense that I believe it, but all the more power to me that I believe it, since it doesn't make any sense. And people can use faith in that sense. Or you can use faith in the sense that I think it should be used if we're being biblical, and that is normal, commonsensical, rational, intellectual commitment to what we're convinced the evidence suggests is true. Well, that's not any different than reason. I mean, faith there is not in contradistinction to reason. It's just another word to describe what I rationally might believe. Whereas this sense of faith over here is completely at odds with and the antithesis of reason. In our culture today, in the wider, broader culture, most secular people out there think that everybody by faith means believing something utterly irrationally and then applauding yourself for doing it. I mean, that's what they think faith means. So oftentimes a Christian and a secularist are talking past each other if they start talking about, you know, this is my faith. They think you're saying, you know, they want to go, oh, that's cute. I'm so glad that you believe what you believe. I mean, they can be very condescending because there isn't really anything very intellectually respectable about what they mean by faith. But that's hopefully not what we mean by faith. So without making the distinction between the different ways you can use that word, there can be a lot of confusion in my own head and certainly in my conversations with other people. I don't know, can any of you think of other examples?
I can think of an example, and I hope I can explain this well enough. We in Christianity want to think of ourselves as loving God, that our love is authentic when we love God. But in the Arminian and Calvinist debate, the Arminian side will say that in order to love God, you have to be free not to love him. So the Arminian type of loving God demands that man have free will. So when all Christians who want to say they love God, they have this emotional, you know, we all feel like we have something at stake when we say we love God. But then you get pulled into the argument by Arminianism that wants to say, well, if your love is really real, then it has to be in an environment where you're free not to love God. That means that human beings have to have free will not to love God, and then pulling you into a place you don't want to go. If man has truly free will, then you end up with a God who doesn't know the future, who's out of control, and it's all to establish an environment where we can all say, yeah, well, my love for God is really authentic because I don't have to love God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think in that particular debate, the concept where the confusion arises is in freedom, the concept of freedom. What exactly do we mean by freedom? And an Arminian believes means absolute autonomy from God, mm-hmm. complete ontological independence from God. A Calvinist believes in freedom also, but they mean it in a different sense. They mean freedom in the sense that I'm not an animal, I'm not a robot, I'm not programmed to love God, I'm making choices out of my human will, and that piece of my humanity is my freedom that makes my choices morally significant. I'm responsible for them. I'm either blameworthy or praiseworthy for them. But without meaning complete autonomy and independence. Yeah. So that's exactly right. There's a lot of confusion that comes from confusion.
And one side can lead you into that place you don't want to go, and it starts with that emotional hook, because I've been in situations where the fear was, well, you can't be a Calvinist because then you'd just be a puppet. That means mm-hmm. that your love can't possibly be authentic. And so the fear of being inauthentic is kind of an emotional hook, and then it leads you right into that place that you don't want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't have the resources to see the distinction you need to see that you don't have to go there. Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly right. Okay, so the Socratic method, he's a midwife. His task is to give birth to wisdom and knowledge in the soul of another person. Socrates doesn't have much use for speech making or writing books. He has whole portions of dialogues on that. Speech writing is, he likens it to entertainment. Escapes me right now, but you're not really doing the work of teaching if you're just making a speech. Now, I think he takes it too far. It is a dialogue, so it's hard to know whether there's not a little bit of exaggeration going on for the sake of argument. That's one of the challenges of reading his dialogues, is how seriously do you take Socrates' positions? Because I do think that it's possible to dialogue with a written work. But you can see what Socrates is getting at is that if I'm in a face-to-face conversation with you, I can, through a bunch of questions, I can figure out what you're not understanding, what you're not getting, what's blocking you from understanding it, and then I can help you get past that and get around that. If I'm writing a book, I have no control over how you're going to respond to what I'm saying. Does my language confuse you further, or does my language clarify to you? I have no control over that. But at least in a conversation, I have some kind of control over how I approach you in order to help you better understand. The even bigger part for Socrates is Socrates seems to be quite aware that it's one thing to get somebody to a place where they grasp with their mind some kind of idea. It's an entirely different thing for them to own it with their soul. And he seems to think the chances of me being able to help you with that, I mean, no one can cause another person to believe. No one can cause another person to embrace it from the depth of their being. But in a one-to-one dialogue, I can appeal to you in such a way that the chances of me being able to do that in a one-to-one dialogue are better than me writing a book at you. That's really not going to be very profitable. So for the things that count, Socrates thinks that actual dialogue with a person, a living person, is really the way to go. So at the end of Phaedrus, he says, the kind of writing I'd like to do is writing on the soul of another person. So very, very helpful perspective, I think. But that all of his method is predicated on his commitment to helping another person get it and not just grasp it intellectually, but grasp it with their soul and believe it. Okay. I think I'm going to call that good on Socrates unless you have some questions.
It just occurred to me that Socrates was the first person who defined what counseling is in that conversation between people that helps you write on the soul of another.
Mm-hmm.
And that is beautiful.
Yeah.
It's exactly it.
That is one of the more profound and wonderful things about Socrates. I mean, he didn't write anything. You know, Jesus didn't write anything. Socrates didn't write anything. Some of the most influential people in human history didn't write anything. And yet he had a huge impact because, for that very reason, I think, is because he was having an impact on individual people's lives, and they wanted to go further with that. Okay, shifting gears then, we'll go to Plato. So one of the people that we know he had a very large impact on was a student of his named Plato. And most of what we know about Socrates, and the best of what we know about Socrates, I think, comes from Plato. I've mentioned that I think Plato alternates between treating Socrates more or less seriously and then turning him into a cartoon character in some of his dialogues, and it makes for a difficult interpretive challenge. But he was the most influential student that Socrates had, that in terms of his influence on us. He was a student of Socrates, I say here in the notes, in these important ways. He had a commitment to the priority of understanding, as Socrates did. So Socrates thought that human excellence really was founded on and rooted on understanding. You had to have knowledge. You had to get it. And I think I commented that I think it overlaps with the biblical perspective in that regard. We have, in Christian culture, we try to drift away from that. We try to de-emphasize understanding in favor of things like worship and love and this and that and the other thing. to the point where we kind of poo-poo theology and doctrine and Bible study and stuff like that. When I was growing up, the way they put it is doctrine divides. What did they put in its place? Relationship, I think, is what they described it as. Our relationship, or our faith is not about doctrine, it's about relationship. Doctrine just divides. So if we want unity with one another and love for one another and stuff, we have to downplay doctrine and get it out of the way. I think in keeping with both Socrates and Plato, I think you have a similar kind of emphasis by the apostles in the New Testament. In Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and understanding. In him we have knowledge. That they're not afraid to emphasize that, because as important as things like love are and goodness and righteousness, what's underlies those things is knowledge. You have to know how to love. You have to know what righteousness is. You have to know why to love. I mean, without the knowledge that undergirds all these other virtues, that we get blown around and blown off our feet. So knowledge is what grounds us in reality, grounds us in what's true. So I think there's an overlap there between the Platonic and Socratic values and the biblical values in that regard. Well, Plato clearly takes that from Socrates. He doesn't qualify that or run away from that at all. He's right there with his teacher. But Plato did expand the scope of Socrates' philosophical inquiry. He took it in a direction that Socrates did not take it, and I don't think would have taken it. And this I think is in a sense a kind of perversion of Socrates, certainly a departure, and I would argue a perversion of Socrates. Socrates was concerned about the truths that define how a human being should live. So what is human existence? What does it mean to be a human being? How should a human being live? The knowledge and understanding that he thought was foundational is the knowledge and understanding that teaches us answers to those questions. And I think that's clearly Socrates' emphasis. Plato comes along and realizes that with the methods that Socrates uses, his dialectic, particularly his dialectical method, you know, making the right kind of distinctions and breaking concepts down into their constituent parts and that kind of thing, that he can take his method, philosophical method, and he can understand everything. You know, he can rule the world. So he's not just going to understand what it means to be a human being. He's going to understand all of cosmic reality, becoming the philosopher who has learned his tools from his master Socrates. And that's far more interesting to Plato than I think it ever was to Socrates, if I have got the distinction between them right. I think the way to understand Plato, and this will help you understand the difference between Socrates and Plato too. So I would describe Plato as a rational mystic. Plato thinks that the fulfillment of your humanity is to gain wisdom, the wisdom that the philosopher seeks. But how do you gain that wisdom? This will make more sense the more we get some Plato under our belts. But the way you gain that wisdom is by contemplating that which is most ultimate. And it's in that act of contemplation, that act of getting your mind around ultimate reality, and I underline ultimate reality, when you finally come to see ultimate reality, you have gained true wisdom, wisdom indeed. And that wisdom that you gain in that kind of contemplation, that's what finally and ultimately is fulfilling your humanity and fulfilling you as a human being. So it's not unlike the mystics in Christianity in the Middle Ages. There's significant difference is the mysticism of Christianity in the Middle Ages actually ran from reason. Reason was an obstacle. Reason got in your way. Reason was the antithesis of coming to be united with God and seeing God and being joined with God and loving God. You had an irrational mystical experience that brought about that union with God that you were seeking to achieve. Plato, I don't think, would have recognized that, because he sees kind of discursive reason, you know what I mean by discursive reason, kind of step by step, you know, working your way through the lines of an argument and thinking through your concepts one at a time and in slow motion, the slow motion reasoning that we all use. He would have seen that as preparatory to your contemplation of what is ultimate. It doesn't get in the way. It's something that's preparatory to that. Some of the medieval mystics would have also argued that it was preparatory, but it was preparatory, the kind of preparation that you needed to throw away once you got to a certain stage. Again, I don't think Plato would have ever thrown it away, because everything about Plato's system involves the mind and rationality. To reason is to be human for Plato and for his student Aristotle. So in contrast to Socrates, now you do have episodes in Plato's dialogues where you have Socrates engaged in what I think is supposed to be a philosopher's contemplation of the ultimate. He's standing out barefoot in a snowstorm, completely oblivious to everything, just kind of knowing it all. And I think that's supposed to be a moment of contemplation. But again, is that Plato reading that into Socrates, or was that the real historical Socrates? If I'm right, that's not true to the real historical Socrates. The real historical Socrates is an existentialist philosopher who is committed to understanding what does it mean to be a human being, and can we get clarity about who I am as a human being and how I should then live my life and then go out and do it. I think that's all he's interested in. All this religious, mystical, contemplative kind of stuff, I think, would have been alien to Socrates. But it's very much at the heart of what makes Platonism Platonism. Without the mysticism, you really don't have Plato, I don't think.
Yeah, but this may be somewhat off topic, but you've said our understanding of Socrates comes from Plato's dialogues. Is that our exclusive source of what we know about Socrates? Obviously, it's our main source.
It's our main source. There's four sources. Plato's dialogues, is it Aristophanes? Clouds. I think it's Xenophon. Has a little bit, and there might be a fourth source I don't have my notes in front of me, so I can't remember what it is. But none of them, other than, if I have it right, does anyone know? Did I say Xenophon before? I've never read his stuff, but I guess there are some interesting pieces of information in there. But otherwise, Clouds is worthless, because I don't think Aristophanes is even talking about Socrates. He's just used Socrates as kind of a representative sophist, and it's really sophists that he's describing, not Socrates. So I think that's worthless as a source. Best I can do, sorry, without my notes. Do you have a follow-up on that?
Not really.
Okay. Now, this next point is critical, especially if you're going to read any Plato and go on and dabble in him at all. But I have to set it up by defining what I call a philosophical prejudice. And what I mean by a philosophical prejudice is some value, some idea, some belief, some concept that a culture shares, but that it doesn't, everybody believes it in the culture, so I don't ever have to defend it in my argument with you or my conversation with you. It's just a given between us. It's a given between us, but it has never been established critically. I've never really sat down and thought, well, why do I believe that value? Or should I believe that value? Or what does it mean to believe that value? I've never had that discussion with other people, and I've never even had those thoughts in my own head. Everybody just knows it, right? well, if everybody knows it, but it's accepted uncritically, that's what I'm calling a philosophical prejudice. All cultures, I'm convinced, have them, have philosophical prejudices. I gave in my notes, I give some example of, I think, in our culture. Traditionally, in this culture, when I was growing up, we were taught very much to love and value democracy and freedom. Now, that is so much a philosophical prejudice that every president in my lifetime has defended wars by, well, we're out to fight and protect freedom. Oh, okay. Well, then that does it. Now, there may very well be an argument that could be made, but they don't need to make an argument. I mean, that's my point, is you don't need to go further and have any discussion or make any argument or explain anything. You've already said all you need to say to someone who's been enculturated as I am to get me on board. That's all you need to say. Same thing with democracy. Well, we're out to advance democracy. Okay, well, that's great. Well, a lot of really smart people have not been so sure that you want to advance democracy in the world. Plato, for one of them, Plato was an enemy of democracy. Democracy is what killed his teacher. Democracy was committed one of the gravest acts of injustice the world has known. So he's not a fan of democracy. Aristotle is rather lukewarm about democracy. I mean, he's afraid of democracy. And because they had read Plato and Aristotle, the founders of America were very wary of democracy. It scared them to death. That's why we have the Constitution we have, is to protect us from democracy, in part. We have a representative democracy, and the representative part is to satisfy Aristotle, because democracy ends up just being mob rule, and the tyranny of a mob is as bad or worse than the tyranny of a tyrant. So we need to protect ourselves from the tyranny of the mob just as much as we do the tyranny of an evil king. But that somewhere along the line that got lost, and democracy just simply became a value, a concept in our culture that all you have to do is say the word and, you know, people are right on board with you. It's a philosophical prejudice. Those traditional ones have been replaced with new ones. Now things like fairness, we talked about that earlier, or diversity. I mean, all you have to do is mention the words and, oh yeah, I'm all for diversity, except when it's the organisms in my body, then I'd rather not have diversity. There are all kinds of contexts in which diversity is bad, not good. But when it's a philosophical prejudice, you're not making those distinctions, you're not making any arguments, you're not understanding why diversity might be valuable when it's valuable. None of that even matters because no one has even thought about it. We just all know that diversity is great. Or fairness. We just all know that fairness is great. Right? Okay, well, that's a philosophical prejudice. Is that clear what I mean by that?
Yes.
One of the things that's most striking when you read Plato for the first time, I remember reading him as an undergraduate, I'd only read one thing by him in high school, but when I started to read more as an undergraduate, it baffled me why everybody went gaga over Plato. I mean, what do you mean this is a brilliant philosopher? You read these dialogues and he's making all these incredibly stupid arguments. And it took me a while to realize, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of them I've mentioned, that sometimes the arguments are not intended to be serious philosophical arguments. They're almost comedy. That's one of the reasons. But one of the biggest contributing factors to that is that Plato is writing out of a set of philosophical prejudices that are very foreign to me, very much not my philosophical prejudices. So any outsider to a culture is going to listen to the arguments the arguments that anyone within the culture have, and they're going to go, wow, these people make no sense at all. How can you let him get away with that? How can he just say that and you grant it and go on in your argument? Don't you have some talking to do here before you let that stand? And that's your response in Plato's Dialogues. If I had my wits about me, I could do a better job of this. But you'll read passages that will go something like, Plato will say, now if something is spiritual, then it is good, right? Oh yes, most certainly, Socrates, that is the most certain thing of all. And if something is good, then it must be unchangeable, right? Oh yes, Socrates, of course, no question about that. You're absolutely right. But if it's unchangeable, then it has to be one, doesn't it? Oh yes, Socrates, most certainly. And if it's one, it has to be rational, right? Yes, most certainly, Socrates. And if it's rational, then it has to be eternal, right? Yeah, so the soul is immortal. I mean, you look at that argument and you go, whoa, wait a minute. I missed a few steps here. We missed a few steps, but they didn't. Because there's one particular philosophical prejudice that I call the Greek dichotomy here that allows them to equate or to necessarily correlate a whole group of things with each other such that without even thinking about it, you can flow from one attribute to the next attribute to the next attribute without even blinking. Don't have to defend it. Don't have to argue for it. Because everybody around him accepts that same dichotomy. So here on your notes, I have the Greek philosophical prejudice reflected by and established by Plato, the Greek dichotomy. My note says one thing commonly meet, it should be meant when referring to something as Platonic. So I have two columns there, and everything in the left column basically is assumed, just automatically assumed, to be correlated with everything else in that column. And then the other column is its antithesis, and everything in that column is just automatically assumed to be correlated with everything else in that column. So in the left column, the spiritual necessarily goes with the immaterial. That's easy because almost true by definition. But then the spiritual and immaterial necessarily go with what is good, which goes with what is beautiful, with what is perfect, with what is real, with what is unchangeable, with what is one, with what is simple, with what is rational, with what is eternal, with what is immortal, with what is universal, and with what is infinite. And by contrast, the other column, everything there is correlated with each other, and everything there is an antithesis of everything in the left column. So what is non-spiritual or material is bad and evil, is non-beautiful, is imperfect, is unreal, is changeable, is many, is composite, is non-rational, is non-eternal, is mortal, particular, and finite. You cannot possibly understand Plato's cosmology without understanding this list and the relationships between the things on this list. Because both Plato and Aristotle, when they argue for their cosmologies, they're going to argue on the basis of this dichotomy right here. Hopefully that'll become clearer when we see some of his doctrines. Well, this is so distinctive. This dichotomy here is so distinctive that when people talk about something being Platonic in its flavor or cast or tone or whatever, more often than not, this is probably what they're talking about. If something has the feel of depending in any way at all on this dichotomy, then that's a kind of a Platonic way of thinking and a Platonic way of looking at the world. The reason I'm spending as much time on it as I am is that it's this dichotomy and the Platonism that is captured here that had an early and deep impact on Christianity. So going from the apostles themselves, who were not at all Platonic, to some of the earliest church fathers, you move from one universe to another universe, from one world to another universe, from a Jewish world to a Platonic world. And that would only be of just sort of mild historic interest, except that the effects of that shift are still with us today. We have not shed all of this completely. We're not nearly as Platonic as the early Christians were, because there's a whole lot of water that's got on under the bridge that has made us a lot of other things besides Platonic. But there's still echoes of this very Platonism, even in our own thinking and arguments and reasons why we have the doctrines that we have and so on down to this day. I mean, even something as simple as how effortlessly could I introduce into the concept that God is infinite? And you go, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, God is infinite. Well, where's the Bible say that? That's not a Jewish concept, that God is infinite. That's Plato's idea. It comes straight out of this list. Because to be strictly speaking infinite, I mean, typically we would probably retranslate that into God is really, really big or something like that. That's what we would mean by that. But technically, to be infinite means to have no boundaries. God is without boundaries. So he encompasses everything. He incorporates everything. There's no distinction between God and that which is not God, because there are no boundaries there. Pantheism likes God being infinite, but theism doesn't, not the theism of the Bible. God is good. He is not evil. There's a boundary between who God is and who he ain't. God is good. He is not evil. And there are other boundaries we could draw. The God of the Bible is a determinate being. You can predicate those things of him that are true and deny of him predicates that are not true of him. Well, that's not infinite then. None of us believe that he's infinite, but we say that he is. Why do we say that he is? Because it's still an echo from a Platonic residue that entered in really early into Christian thought. I think arguably you had priests in the Roman Catholic Church quite early adopting celibacy. Why did they adopt celibacy? Well, if you'll notice, the material is correlated with the bad and the evil. And we all know that the material correlates with our physical bodies. So anything and everything that has to do with our physical bodies is necessarily on the wrong side of the dichotomy. If you want to be spiritual, on the other side of the dichotomy, you're going to avoid and distance yourself from anything that is bad or evil, which is to say material, which is to say physical, which is to say sexual. You can't possibly have someone be both sexual and truly spiritual at the same time in a Platonic worldview. And by the way, I think this worldview in Plato probably dates back to the Pythagoreans, because we saw that, you know, we saw that the flesh is bad, the material is bad in Pythagoras. So now maybe there are other way. I'm sure there are other factors in the history of ideas that have entered into certain Christian attitudes toward sexuality, and there are and maybe the attitude that sexuality is inconsistent with spirituality would have somehow found a way to be there anyway without Plato, but I don't think it's, you know, I think it's highly unlikely that part of that dichotomy has not been an inheritance that it got interjected into Christianity really early on by Platonism.
Can you do just a brief, not exactly a timeline, but just how did it happen? How did it integrate into Christianity?
I don't think there's a simple answer to that question, because I think there were a lot of doors that Plato came into Christianity through. A big one was a guy named Philo, who was not a Christian but a Jew. Philo would have been a contemporary of Jesus and Paul, a Jew who lived in... Philo was enamored by Plato, and he completely reinterpreted the Old Testament, basically trying to argue that Moses was a better Plato than Plato was, kind of idea, and that all of the Platonic ideas can be found in the Old Testament. In the Jewish scriptures. Now, that's a bit of a challenge, to find Plato's ideas in the Jewish scriptures. So you have to come up with methods of interpretation that allow you to allegorize the text. It seems to say one thing, but you want it to say something else instead. How are you going to do that? Well, you allegorize, or you find levels of meaning. There's all kinds of different devices. Well, those hermeneutical methods got directly taken by the Christians in Alexandria, Clement and Origen, and that the whole Alexandrian school. They were students of Philo. I mean, they adopted his interpretive methods and brought that into Christianity. They too were, and not only his interpretive methods, but also his love of Plato. If you read Justin Martyr, an early Christian apologist, we read him in the curriculum here at Gutenberg, and his defense of Christianity, basically the reason you pagans should be Christians is because we're better Platonists than you are, essentially. So I don't know why they were so enamored of him. I mean, why Plato in particular? I don't know why. I think the dynamic is easy for me to understand because it's been with us always, and that is we lust for intellectual respectability. So whatever it is that's going to give us intellectual respectability, we're attracted to it like moths to a light bulb. And I think that's what was going on in the ancient world is, even when the Romans conquered Greece, Greece actually conquered Rome culturally because the apex of civilization and culture was Greek thought and Greek practices and Greek ideas and Greek literature and so on. So that's the soup in which they live, is if you want to be somebody respectable and important, you're going to be Greek. So if you want Christianity, which is this outcast religion that, how can you make that respectable? Well, let's Hellenize it. Let's Greekize it. So I think that's the dynamic. Why Plato in particular, I'm not sure.
So Bill's wondering, back towards the beginning when you said that Plato was a rational mystic, he has a definition of mystic that I think he's wondering if he has right. Is it someone who contemplates, so that when he's a rational mystic, he contemplates rationality, or like what exactly?
Okay, yeah. No, what I mean by mystic is the contemplation piece. The thing that makes contemplation is that it's direct, spontaneous, immediate. You just have this flash of connection with whoever or whatever you're trying to be united with. In irrational mysticism, you want to be united with God, and often the metaphor they use is not knowledge but love. You're absorbed into the love of God, and you love God, and you're united with God in love. It really is an experience that transcends the ordinary. That's what I mean by mystical. It's some kind of experience that transcends the ordinary that they describe and interpret as being united with God. Plato wants to be united with God, if you will. Sometimes he might call it God. Other times he'll call it the good or the one or the beautiful. He wants to be united with it, but he wants to be united with it rationally and intellectually. So love is what draws you to it in Plato's thinking. But the connection that you make is a connection with your mind. You know, you make intellectual contact. You know the one. You don't love the one, you know the one. So that's why I'm calling it a rational mysticism. If the class goes on long enough, we might talk a little bit about Polanyi, who was a very helpful author to me, a 20th century author, who impressed upon me the importance of recognizing that there's two different levels at which rationality functions, what he calls the articulate level, and then also at the tacit level, and that there's so much of what my mind grasps that it doesn't know that it grasps it. It grasps it intuitively, tacitly, unconsciously, if you will. And most of the important stuff we know tacitly, not articulately. So there, part of what gives some plausibility to rational mysticism or what he's talking about is that you can be engaged in ratiocination, that is methodical reasoning, step-by-step methodical reasoning. You can be engaged in that and kind of not getting anywhere, go to sleep, wake up in the middle of the night with the answer to your problem you're trying to solve. Well, how does that happen? Because it comes as an intuitive hunch, as a kind of spontaneous, directly to you kind of hunch, you could argue it's some kind of non-rational process. But I think a much better way to analyze that is it's your reason working at warp speed up here, at underneath consciousness, at a level that you're not aware that you're even working at it. Your mind is working away at a problem. And when all of a sudden you see the answer, now you can begin the task of articulating it. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had this problem, but working on a math or physics problem or some puzzle, you see it before you know what you see. Have you ever had that experience? Okay, now I know how to do it. If someone asks you how, you'd go, well, I don't know yet. I mean, you've seen the answer, but now you have to articulate it even to yourself before you can articulate it at all. But it's not that you haven't seen it. It's only a matter of time now. You're going to be able to work out the details and show somebody that you have seen the solution to the problem. But you actually see the solution before you know you have the solution. And I think that's what gives credence to something like a rational mysticism, is we do have those experiences where we have flashes of insight. And I think that's what Plato is calling true wisdom, is that he's likening to that. What if you could have a hunch, and in your hunch, the content of your hunch was the knowledge of everything. I know it all. In one blinding flash, I know everything there is to know. I mean, that would be wisdom indeed. And that highest kind of knowledge is going to, or knowledge of the highest kind of stuff is going to have to be correlated, as we will see next January, with the highest kind of knowledge. And Plato is inclined to think contemplation is a higher kind of knowledge than ordinary rational belief. There's that kind of the spectacular immediacy of it. It makes it somehow superior. And I think he's wrong about that. But you can see why that becomes plausible. Well, I guess I've kept you too long.